welcome into the all-new All Ball. Man, do we have a great pod for you. So excited. Frank Haith, longtime friend, head coach of Tulsa, the Golden Hurricane, who finished in first place in the AAC, will be my guest. We'll get his thoughts on why he left Miami, why he left Mizzou, how close they were to being special at Tulsa, what this is like. And, oh yeah, by the way, he has a personal thought on the protests and on police brutality, and kind of something interesting that he learned about the Tulsa race riots only after this took place. And now, obviously, I think that's going to change how he coaches and teaches his men in the future. Also on this pod, we got a kind of a double hit for you. It should be really, really good. Brandon Goble joins us. He is, if you follow Hoops, you know has a Twitter handle at JUCO Advocate. Here's a guy who will go anywhere to find any player and give him a chance to be seen. All right, it's pretty cool. So Brandon Goble and Frank Haith. First, let's get to our conversation with the head coach of the Tulsa Golden Hurricane.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Let's welcome him in. He's the head coach of the Tulsa Golden Hurricane. He's Frank Haith. And Frank, there's a bunch of things I'd love to get with you on this podcast. But let me start with something that I did not know until listening to some of your remarks on other podcasts and other outlets that, and maybe this is something I've probably learned, is, man, everybody's life experience is so different when we see police brutality and there's this massive, now international, movement to end it and to change so many things with how police are purporting themselves. It strikes home, I think, especially sharply with you. Sean Bell was your, nephew, and he was shot and killed in New York?
Yes, he was my nephew, and back in 2006, he was at his bachelor party at a club with some friends and a couple of my other brothers, and he was getting married the next day, and so he was leaving the club. There's three undercover cops in the club, and I'm assuming that one police officer, just unidentified, misidentified Sean, and pulled a gun out on him. And Sean obviously acted like any normal human being because he never said who he was, and got in his car and tried to escape, he and two of his friends. And there was 50 rounds shot into the car, and he was killed. His two friends survived it. One of his friends was shot 14 times and survived it. But no drugs, no guns, no weapons, no nothing. I think it's something in my case, Doug, when it happened, I was a head coach in Miami, and this was 14 years of not really talking about it. And I think at the time, I was concerned, worried about my brand, maybe, I don't know, or afraid, not knowing what to say, how to say it, don't want to say the wrong thing, don't want to come off as a, someone that's against policing. Just so many things, so many factors, as I said yesterday, I felt guilty, I felt shame, as George Floyd situation played out in front of us, and I called my brother yesterday because it's the first time I had a conversation about Sean and speaking on it, and I apologize, but it was a tough time for our family. And that's something that stayed with me. And I never even talked about it with any of my teams until this team this year. And I think the reason for doing that was to say to them it could happen to anybody. And we've all, as black men, taught our kids and have been taught how to engage, the terms of engagement with policemen in terms of how we should act. You know, respect, ask questions, don't argue, show your hand. But in this case, in Sean's case, he didn't have that opportunity. And it was a difficult time for our family, but every time we see some of these incidents, it just brings back that pain that we as a family endured back in 2006.
I'm in no way impugning your level. Like we know each other for a long time. A lot of people don't know about it, so I'm not. But did you know about the race riots of the 1920s in Tulsa before it had been, you know, kind of brought to people's attention following George Floyd's death?
I you know what? I did not. And it's funny, Doug. Not funny, but you know, it's not taught in the history books here, and it's something that I think, as I talk to people, that's really a sensitive subject. And I did not know about it. And then obviously when I hear Russell Westbrook and LeBron James doing this documentary and learning about it, that's why I decided to do something with our team. And I think as a coach, Doug, and you know this, you know, we have a calling. We have to educate, to teach. That's what we do. We're coaches. And I looked at this as a opportunity to continue to educate our kids. And we've had a couple of Zoom calls to talk about some things and to talk about George Floyd, but also talk about, you know, I sent them a link on, the Black Wall Street. And I asked them to watch it. Then the next week we talked about it. And, you know, something so historic is right here in our town. And I don't think I haven't interjected that with any of my teams here. And so we wanted to have a unity walk, not a protest, a unity walk to show solidarity, to show that we're unified. I've got black players, white players, you know, and we have something we want to do to honor the three tragedies, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and to have an educational piece of it at the end, walk into Black Wall Street, the Greenwood Culture Center. And it was, we did some, you know, putting it together in terms of how far the walk would be and able to honor those three tragedies. And we started at 10 o'clock. We got together at 10 o'clock and we started our walk at 10:14. And 10:14 is George Floyd's birthday. And then as we started our walk, we got to the end of Delaware. You know Delaware because you know Tulsa. We paused and had a moment of silence for 27 seconds. Breonna's birthday was that last Friday, and she turned 27, so we wanted to honor her. And then the walk from there to the Culture Center was 2.23 miles. And Ahmaud Arbery's birthday is February 23rd. So that way we're able to honor all three of those and to get there. And then it wasn't open, but just so happened we were able to communicate with someone in there, and they allowed us to go in, and our players were able to see a lot of the, you know, stuff that was been archived and about Black Wall Street, and I think that was a great experience for us as a basketball team, and something that I think that we will continue to do in the future in terms of educating our young people.
I had no idea the level of racism, because I feel like Tulsa's a lot, very Midwestern. Obviously, you know, you live there, but for people who don't, like, but I started to know the history of Tulsa and like, hey, did you know this happened? And guys on my team had talked who are from Oklahoma, like, did you know this? I had no idea. It is fascinating that in these moments and now, with your experience now kind of learning about it, we're all kind of realizing even the flaws to how we've educated kids. Right. Like this is
right.
the bit. What are we teaching our children about history? What are we teaching children that they can use kind of in the future as a coach and as a father and as a mentor? And you mentor even guys that are still playing in the NBA today who you recruited going back to your days at Wake and, of course, at Texas. What should we be teaching our children? What are the right messages that we need to relate, especially to our players?
Well, you know, as I've talked to our guys about a couple things, is we you know, the George Floyd murder situation is allowed us, as tragic as it was, I think we're starting to see change, and it's given us a platform as coaches to have serious conversations that are uncomfortable and about a lot of things that and I think we got to continue to have this conversation in terms of teaching and educating our young people until they become comfortable. But to me, we talk about a lot of things in terms of, I wish the world was a team. Because, you know, and you played on a team. When you're in a locker room, a football locker room or a basketball locker room team, what are you teaching? You're teaching respect, love for each other, play for each other, care about each other, doing things together. And that's what we need in a time of crisis. That this, you know, our country's in a lot of pain right now. But I see the protesting and I see just as many white people as I see black people out protesting. That gives us all hope. I see it not just in the United States, but all over the world. I think this has spurned a lot of different feeling than we've had in the past when we have these situations. And this is for the generation after us. And I think that's what we're doing. If everyone would receive that, you know, let's teach a little bit of love. Let's teach caring for each one another. And I think the one thing we talk about, other thing we talk about, our guys, is voting. And I know Coach Ravenel at Georgia Tech, his comments were so profound, so awesome, and an encouragement, and taking November 3rd off, but helping our kids understand what you know, they have a voice. They can be a part of change. And it's not about voting for the presidency. It's about local. We taught our guys, because we got guys from all over the country to absentee vote. We want to help them understand, but they need to get educated on, you know, things that you want to see happen in your communities. And, you know, you're voting for city councilmen. You're voting for all kinds of things that are going on that can create some change. And I think helping educate our young people to understand they have a voice is the most important thing.
Frank, why'd you get into coaching?
You know, my father, I moved down south from New York when I was a very young, 5 years old. So I was raised by my grandparents, my grandmother. And my coaches were my father figures. I actually knew I wanted to coach. My first team sport I played on I was a 10-year-old Mike's or Pee Wee's football team, and Dr. Alan White was my football coach. He was also the athletic director at Elon College. And my people that I looked up to that had the impact on my life and growing up were my coaches. And I said, I want to do that. I wanted to impact young people like I've been impacted by my coaches. And I went through college. I couldn't get through it fast enough because I thought I was going to be a high school coach and teach, I don't know, health and kinesiology, PE, and that was going to be my career, because those are the people that had the profound effect on me.
So how'd you get your first job? So you get done with Elon College, right? And then how did you like, take me through the steps of which you actually became a coach there?
Well, when I decided I didn't want to go far away from home. My grandmother was ill my senior year, and so I went to Elon, which is where I grew up. And as I said, the athletic director there was my first coach, Dr. Alan White. And you know, first year, my grandmother passes away, and obviously I paid for my education. I didn't get a scholarship. I paid for schooling, and I had all kinds of jobs. You know, I worked in a mill cleaning machines. I did floors. I stripped floors and polished floors. I cut grass. I paid my education. And so after my freshman year, Dr. White came to me, because I was going back to my high school and being a volunteer football and basketball assistant. He came to me and said, listen, Frank, look, I've got a proposition for you to help you with school. We want you to live in the gym. And we had this closet. It was literally like a closet. And we could turn it into a space where you could live, and you took care of the gym. And that's how it helped me. And I still had some loans, but that's how I finished up paying for school. And then I got involved with working with Bob Burton, who was the head coach at Elon at the time. And then I worked with Jerry Steele. I worked camps, worked seven straight weeks of camp with Jerry Steele. I started working five-star and prep stars. I got to know coaches through that in the summertime. But I would go out recruiting my junior and senior year in college. I had this 74 hatchback Pinto I would go recruiting in that had to put oil in every 100 miles because it would run out of oil. But that's how I got started, and the rest kind of was history. And, you know, when Dave Odom got the job at Wake Forest, Jerry Steele said, you got to hire this guy. And was my first college job beyond Elon was I was a GA at Wake Forest for 1 year, and I became a full-time assistant with Kevin Easton right after that. And I popped around with a couple other places working with some outstanding coaches, and Tony Baroni, Rick Barnes, Jerry Dunn, and Kevin Easton. So I've been very blessed getting into the profession, and then I had opportunities as a head coach at Miami and Missouri and now at Tulsa.
I got a bunch to get. I got so many players I want to. First time you saw Chris Paul was when?
Oh, when he was a ninth grader. And he was a beast. That little sucker was so good. And we were the first school to offer him. And, you know, and actually,
I thought he didn't make varsity until, like, his junior year.
Oh, no. I don't know if he didn't make varsity. I saw him as a ninth grader. And Tim Fuller was assistant coach at East Forsyth High School. And Tim played at Wake Forest, so he told me about Chris. So I would see Chris, and we offered him. We offered him his 10th grade year, and at Wake Forest, and then he ended up, you know, Skip recruited him. Process Dave took the job at South Carolina during his senior year, and he got a little hairy there for Wake, but I think they were always going to get him because he's right there, a hometown guy.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's pretty interesting. I mean, how the talent you mentioned Skip, Tony Baroni, who passed away, Dave Odom, who of course you worked for. Let me start with Dave Odom. If you were to say, hey, this is what made Dave Odom special, different, unique, what would it be?
You know, Dave was always under control. I mean, you never felt like he lost his composure during the games. He handled any type of adversity with calmness. And I think that's one thing I took from him. You know, he never got too high. He never got too low. It's funny, you watch those moments, those back-to-back ACC championships, and he's calmly walks over and sits on the bench when everybody's going crazy. But that was Dave. And I don't, You know, tough losses, great wins. He was the same guy. And he was always very much glass half full kind of guy, and kept things in perspective. And I appreciate his calmness and allowing me to grow as a coach. I mean, I think I was so blessed to work with guys that really allowed me as a young coach to be involved with everything, every aspect that it is to become a head coach, and Dave was so good to me in that regard.
Your career trajectory, I felt like, took off when you got to work with Rick Barnes. Not that it hadn't been building, but the level of guys you were guys able to recruit, and Texas was really kind of killing it, and you were known as the guy. That's one of the things that allowed you to get that Miami job. Okay, so you're at Wake. You're from, you're from New York technically, but you grew up in Carolina. How did the move to Texas take place?
You know, I got to know Rick when he was at Clemson. You know, he was, if you recall Rick's time at Clemson, he was a tough dude now. But seeing him on recruiting trails and talking to him. You know, Rick's a personable guy. We're both from North Carolina. He went to Lenore Ryan. I went to Elon, you know, old Carolina Conference guys. So we had a lot in common conversation. And Rick tried to hire me. When I came back to Wake, Rick tried to hire me. I was there 2 or 3 years, and we'd start recruiting. Like, I recruited Josh Howard, Darius Singala, and I wasn't ready. I said, I got to see it through here, Coach. I couldn't do it as many. Got the Texas job a year after he lost Ricky Stokes, and I stayed. And I said, but Coach, if it ever opens again, I'll consider it. And then Rob Lanier leaves and takes a Sienna job, and then I went. And it was an easy transition because that was when Dave left Wake and was going to South Carolina. So I went to Texas with Coach, and obviously Coach turned Texas around. I don't know if people understand where the program was. I mean, I think, you know, they were solid, but Coach took Texas to another level. And the guys we recruited then, it all started with T.J. Ford. But it wasn't quite cool yet to go to Texas, being from Texas. And T.J. made it cool to go to Texas. And he was the first one. And then, obviously, from Daniel Gibson to LaMarcus Aldridge. But one of my greatest recruits there was one that nobody hardly recruited, and that was P.J. Tucker. Nobody recruited P.J., and I remember bringing P.J.'s name to Coach, and I went to North Carolina, I saw P.J. play, because I had roots here in North Carolina. I would go back and recruit, and he played a kid, you probably remember his name, Shavlik Randolph.
Sure.
Who was the number one player in the country, and I was at the game, and P.J. had like 40 and 20, some crazy number, and 20 rebounds, and I remember going back to Coach, this kid is something special. And the coach was like, what position is he? I don't know. He's the player. I don't know where you put him at on the court. And he said, why ain't Carolina or Duke or even Wake Forest or any of those guys recruiting him? Coach, I don't know. I mean, but I think I know he can play for us. And the first we signed him, and Coach never saw him, but he did call his buddy John Lentz to verify that he could play. And John Lentz was the head coach of North Carolina. Yeah, Frank's right. He's a good player. So first workout, P.J., is awful. I mean, god awful. He throws up in the trash can. He's out of shape. And our river coach just killing me about him. He actually started killing me when he was on a visit because we went to this place and PJ ordered like fried lobster tails. And they were so expensive. And PJ was whooping those bad boys down one bite. He ended up being a pretty good one, and he left after 3 years, and obviously he was a Big 12 player of the year, and he's still playing in the NBA.
You get your first job at Miami. What's that like? You've been doing it for 15 years or so, and now you're the head coach at a big-time program. What do you remember about your first days on the job there?
Yeah, first when I got here, which is pretty awesome, Leonard Hamilton flew in. He became the head coach at Florida State. You know, he was a former head coach in Miami and went and coached the Wizards. He flew in and he met me and he took me around town and gave me some advice. And I was, you know, I got to know Coach Hamilton a little bit through the profession, but the fact that he took is, I thought it was kind of, you know, we were competitors now. We're going to be competing against each other. But he showed me around town, explained, you know, people I needed to know in town, and that was unbelievable in terms of giving me some comfort level. But I felt good about the opportunity, even though the program was struggling at the time. We went through some tough times in terms of they were making a transition from the Big East back to the ACC, and you know, we were able to, in 7 years, 5 years of postseason, even though, you know, one NCAA tournament, but five NITs, that was still an upgrade from where the program was. And Miami was a program that needed a lot. We built a practice facility. There's a lot of things that needed done to upgrade the program to get it to the level it needed to be consistently competitive in the ACC. And Jim's done a tremendous job after me taking it to another level. But it was a, you know, I was 38 years old, and, we were able to get some things accomplished here in terms of the type of teams we built. And that team, Jack McClinton, had coached a kid that, and I think, Doug, you did one of our games in New York, St. John's. We played St. John's. Jack McClinton became an unbelievable player here that would transfer from Tiana, and he's got his number in the Raptors. One of the all-time leading three-point shooters in the ACC, and had a tremendous career at Miami.
Yeah, no, I was before I knew I was going to have you on, I was researching, and I remember, like, I saw your second game at Miami, you lost to South Carolina State, and I just wonder what, like, that, can you compare that to, like, a couple years later, you guys start out 12-0, you win a preseason tournament, you beat VCU and Providence and Mississippi State and St. John's. What's that like from early on where you're, and I don't know if you ever question yourself, like, man, is this thing going to work, to all of a sudden, it takes a couple years. What's it like when it hits, when you're like, this will work?
Well, you know, I think when you have, I've been very blessed, Doug, and we talked about some of the people I've worked for and people that I could call and rely on in terms of from their experiences. And, you know, George Raveling was someone else that I leaned on. And, you know, that South Carolina State was, you know, eye-opener, but I think, you know, I felt like we had some solid players that we could build on, but, you know, it was just being consistent. I had good people working with me. You know, you have to have a good staff. You know, you're only as good as the people around you that kept me encouraged and motivated. And my family, you know, my wife was tremendous. And, you know, I had this opportunity, and I knew I was prepared because of the coaches that I've worked for to give me the tools that I needed to be successful. And I embraced those opportunities that I had. I tell young coaches this all the time. Whoever you work for, you don't just, particularly being a young African-American coach in this business, you get labeled as just a recruiter. You know, I get my first job because, you know, I was able to have the number one recruiting class in the country with LaMarcus Aldridge and Daniel Gibson and Mike Williams and all those guys. But you better be able to handle all the things that come along with being a head coach. You better be able to do speaking engagements. You better be able to do radio interviews. You better be able to do scheduling.
How do you learn if you don't know how, right? The speaking stuff, you're very good at it, but you've always, we met when you were at Texas, and like, you've never been somebody who like, well, that guy really needs to work on his presentation. But if that's not something you do naturally well, how do you work on it?
I think you learn, you get better by doing. And I was fortunate enough to have coaches, when we would play on big Mondays, you know, in the Big 12, Rick Barnes wouldn't do that call. We had our conference calls on Monday. So I would do his part of conference calls on Mondays when we play on Big Monday with the radio and answer questions. So you learn, you get better at it by doing. And I tell young coaches, you can't, like, you're not going to be good at it the first time you do it. You know, Kim English, who worked for me, the first time he did a scouting report, he struggled. Kim English is one of the, he's a stud. He is a star in this business. But he'll tell you the first time he did a scouting report, he struggled. And I think you learn, you get better by doing. And you can't be discouraged. It's like riding a bike, right? You fall, you get back on that bike and ride it again. And you get better by continue to be persistent, continue to do it, continue to work on it, continue to practice, but you have to actually do it. I think that's how you get better.
Why the Missouri job?
Yeah, you know, I was here 7 years, and I enjoyed Miami. We still own our home in Miami, Doug, and the traction there at that time was the fan base, the rapid fan base, the energy, and you know, I just wanted something different. And I love what we had, because I thought we had created a program that was going to be just take off here at Miami, and Jim came in, and obviously they did, but we had a lot of young guys here, and it was hard for me, and I was really emotional telling those guys that I was leaving, and because I knew with Daquan Jones, and we had Kenny Kaji sitting out, we had, you know, we had so many guys, you know, Reggie Jones, that we were going to be really, really good. Malcolm Grant, Durant Scott, I mean, we were going to be really good. But I wanted something different. And it was tough, but I, you know, 3 years, we won 76 games at Missouri. You know, three straight postseason. We lose. That first team was terrific. There was yes. Senior laden. We only had 7 scholarship players, win 30 games. But we also won 46 games the next 2 years, and we had recruited well enough to continue some success there. But I, you know, I enjoyed my time at Missouri. I had a great experience there because we were really good, had a great fan base. And, you know, at that time, I just felt like I wanted something different. I wanted to try something different. I was young enough, you know, to do it. And, but I enjoyed my time there, and we still have great friends, great relationships here in Miami, because this is probably going to be our home whenever we hang it up.
You mentioned that first team, of course, was famous for not just having 7 scholarship players, but you guys, you were the first to really, really commit to true small ball. Like, we played small when I was at Oklahoma State, and we had Mason at the 4, but Ricardo Ratliff as, you know, just a junkyard dog inside as your 5, and the Pressy boys, Kim was really your 4 man, right? Who's like a point power forward, and Marcus Denman. How'd that come to? Was that just? What is it? Necessity is the root of all invention, or was that the plan the second you got there?
It wasn't the plan, and you know, Lawrence Bowers was an all-conference player. Towards ACL. I was out recruiting, and he tears his ACL. And so, you know, we really didn't have a lot of size. You know, we had a kid, Kadeem Green, was a freshman that was redshirt a year before, and he ended up leaving middle of the year. And it was one of those things where I looked at our team, and I said, we got to have our best players out here. And, you know, Kenny was, and I called Kenny in, and he'll tell you a story verbatim. I said, Kim, we're going to have to probably play you at the 4. And I need you. I know you vision yourself being a off guard in the NBA. But you're going to play like a guard, and you're going to play this position. But you're smart enough, and you're tough enough to be able to handle it on both ends of the floor. Obviously, they're going to have a tough time guarding you. But you're going to be good enough to do it on the defensive end. And now we'll give up some things, but here's what I want you to focus on. Just keeping your guy off the glass. Just keep your guy off the glass. And you're going to be, and with your quickness, you'll have your way. And we played Kansas twice that year. And Kimmy, I love to tell you, Jeff Whitty, who was a 7-footer, he had a guard because Ricardo had to guard Thomas Robinson. And Jeff Whitty struggled 2 times against Kim. And, but Kim was intelligent. He would front end. He would, you know, he was stripping him on the way on his turn. And then he had a, you know, a hard time guarding him. But they ended up, you know, I give Bill credit, they ended up putting a guard on him on the other end, too, the second time we played them. It was something. And then we just had a system where we taught spacing. Those guys really were comfortable with sharing the ball. And that was something I thought, coming from the year before. They averaged a lot of assists. But, you know, Marcus Denman and Kim English, Ricardo, they were scorers. And even Mike Dixon, they were all scorers. But getting them to understand it doesn't matter. There's going to be some guys tonight. We got enough guys that can score. They share the ball like crazy, Doug. And it's still to this day, I think the numbers of that team, offensive points per possession, is one of the since they started doing that, one of the best in the country in terms of once they started doing that stat. And we were lethal. We had a big man that shot 72% or 70% from the floor. And then those guys are so good at you know, when we got space and they could play in space and they could shoot. So you really struggle figuring out how to defend them, you know, and, you know, could you, if you got up on them, they all could handle the ball well enough to deck it to go by you. If you stayed off them, they all could shoot it. And so, but we also had a threat inside if we didn't make jump shots, which allowed that to open up the perimeter game. So it was, that was a team that, you know, that was determined too. They had good leadership in Marcus and Kenny. And I really believed, when you look at that team is really good. But if Mike Dixon stays with us the next year, I thought that team was going to be even better. Because we had Phil, Mike, and then we had recruited, you know, Lawrence Bowers came back. We had Alex Wojcicki. We had Jabari Brown. We had Keon Bell. That team was super, super talented and had a chance to be really good. But then we lost Mike Dixon before the season got going.
If someone were, if you wanted to make a statement about how and why it ended at Missouri, right? What would you want people to understand?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I had a great. My family loves Columbia, and my daughter's she dances competitively. And the dance company at CPAC was tremendous in helping her get her start. My wife loved the college town. It was one of those things, Doug, that, you know, I'll be honest with you. You know, I had, you know, I was told at that time that, you know, I was getting an extension and then it didn't happen. And you know, from a professional standpoint, you're nervous. You got to look out for your family. You got to do what's best for your family. And I didn't feel good about that situation because of that. You know, and there's nothing. I didn't take anything personal. I felt like I had to do something. I had to do what was best for my family. And at that point in time, you know, I felt we were successful and we were going to continue to be successful. I wasn't confident that, they had enough confidence in me and supporting me to continue to be their head coach. And that's just being honest. And, but, you know, like I said, there's no hard feelings because I love Mizzou. I still root for Conzo to do well there. I have a lot of passion for that university and what it stands for. But that was a tough decision for me to make at that time. But, you know, obviously the only thing that was on my mind was doing what was best for me and my family.
You get to Tulsa, and obviously anybody who knows anything about basketball, Tulsa has had some amazing coaches, right? I mean, they had a run there. You know, where you had Tubby, Steve Robinson, Bill Self, Buzz Peterson, right? Like where you're like, man, just kind of lining up coach after coach. And, you know, you can go back, obviously, to the early, mid-80s when they had Nolan as their head coach. Great history of being competitive. But there was some dormant years. Of course, you replaced Danny Manning, who had taken him to the NCAA tournament. When you first got to Tulsa, a lot of people thought, hey, he's going to be there for a year or two, then he's going to move on. That's what everybody does at Tulsa. When you first got on boots on the ground in Tulsa, what'd you think?
Yeah, I was excited about you know, obviously when you take a new job, you're excited about another start. And, you know, I knew about the tradition of the program, but I knew we were going to have a different challenge on our hands, Doug, because we were going to take on a job that was going to be joining a conference at a different level. You know, the American Conference was obviously a lot different than Conference USA. And playing the competition that we were playing. I mean, UConn had just won a national championship 2 years prior, and we were joining a conference with the national champion in it. So, but obviously, I think you look at my career, I've had jobs where we were taking over jobs. You know, when I came to Miami, we were just joining the ACC. When I went to Missouri, we were only in the Big 12 yet, and we went to the SEC. And you know, obviously, the move there, Compensation Save, was a huge jump. It was a different jump than those other jumps. And but I was excited about the opportunity. We had some really good players in our program. I mean, James Woodard and Shaquille Harrison were really good players. And those guys, that backcourt, when you got good guards, and you know this, you're a really good guard on the team. And, when you got good guards, you got a chance. And so I felt like we had a chance. And obviously, we were able to get back to the tournament my second year. And Shaquille Harrison is now still playing the NBA. And here's a guy who's a two-star recruit that's playing the NBA. And Danny did a good job here. And I'd say Doug Wojcik, who recruited a lot of those players too. There were some good, solid players here. And we were a senior-laden team, junior-laden team. And we were able to, since we've been in this league, Doug, we've won the third most games in this league. I don't know that people know that. Behind Cincinnati and Houston. And, we won more games in Memphis and Temple and other traditional rich basketball clubs in this league. But I was excited for the challenge of, taking over a team that's got some great tradition and joining a league that had some really good basketball, good coaches. And I looked at it as a great opportunity to continue to grow and I was excited about and then we add Wichita State, and I think it's been a great transition for them in this league and helping our league, and I think our league is perceived to be one of the better leagues in the country.
Then you finally get it right? You get to your kind of the sweet spot where this year you're in first place in the league, and now you can't go. An NCAA tournament appearance was pretty much a definite, right? And then it gets canceled,
definite, right?
Yeah, it was a weird year. I couldn't see you not getting in. You beat Houston. You guys are playing well going. Yeah. I mean,
you beat Houston,
Had an opportunity had the conference tournament been played to beat those teams a second time, which would have been end of discussion, right? But you beat, it's not, you had road wins as well. It wasn't just that you'd won home games. Your team had gotten better as the year went on. You check kind of all the boxes for me, what looks and feels like an NCAA tournament team, you win your league. What has it been like though for kind of the dormancy of 3 months after really having your team rolling and expecting to get an NCAA tournament berth?
It was tough, and it's funny. We were all at the tournament, conference tournament, and you had the first round bye. You're starting to see the buzz with the cancellations of tournaments. And we got that word. We had to relay that to our team. We had two seniors that were terrific student athletes. And Martin Zibano, first team all-leaguer, and Lawson Carita. And the conversation and then the look on their face of emotion was tough. It was tough. And then we drove to the tournament, and that drive back was tough. And then going in the locker room and visiting with those guys when we got back, just the finite of that was just incredible. I mean, how do you end the season? Obviously nobody has ended a season just like that. And we had a team that, I think the way we played, Doug, you establish yourself as a coach, and you talked about how we played at Missouri, and you do different things. But the way that team played defense, I thought gave us a chance to really be a problem for people in postseason play. And I felt like, and we were a confident team. And when you get your team to play to a level where they believe in what they're doing, you got rotations, you got roles defined, and everybody's buying in. Now you feel good about you got something special, because it's hard to get to that point, right? When you're building your team throughout the year, when you finally feel like you're at that point where everybody understands their role, they embrace it. They understand it and embrace it. You got confidence in how you're playing. You know how you want to play. In terms of your execution, and I felt like it was a tough time, and but it was the right call, in terms of what was going on in our country, and I think that whereas I was disappointed and hurt for our seniors and our program, but it was the right call.
Okay, now you have, as much as you know, you lose Igbanu, he was a monster, right? Just an absolute monster, 6'8", 235. Really, really talented kid. But most of your team is back next year. How have you, like, how challenging has it been to re-recruit them, get your new guys kept? Like, what has this been like for you?
It's such a, different, right? Because we signed three guys or four guys this spring without even them visiting. And so that's been tough. You know, and keeping your guys engaged, and there's a moment of nothing, right? No gym, no, you can't be anywhere but isolated, but continuing to visit with those guys is extremely important. And at the level where we're at, where this transfer epidemic has become something that's prevalent, and. But I will tell you that we've done a really good job of spending time with our players, talking with them, and with the Zoom, with the technology we have today, with Zoom calls, and we're able to have a really good recruiting class too. I'm excited about that. Will give us some pieces. Missing Ibano is going to be tough because he's a first team all leaguer, and even Lawson too. Although Lawson's numbers don't really say what his value was to our team, and he's tremendous in the locker room, but also execution. And you understand this, Doug. Execution wise, he's unbelievable on both ends of the floor, and those things don't show up in his stats. Like, he was always in the right place in our matchup zone. He was always where he needed to be in terms of rotating, taking a charge, or in terms of the rules in our zone. And then on offense, in terms of movement, ball movement, what about having that guy, and you were this guy, that one guy on your team that moved the ball, that you could absolutely count on when you needed ball movement, that ball gets, sticky, no Velcro. You want that ball to start sticking, you want that one guy, when he got it, he was going to reverse it. And, sure. And could knock down an open shot when he had it. But that's what Lawson brought to this team. So we'll miss those two guys, but we had two guys sitting out are really good, two Oklahoma kids. Curtis Haywood, the transfer from Georgia Tech, and Keyshawn Embry Simpson, the transfer from Arkansas. So I think our perimeter game will be really, really good. We have to see what we will have to be, our post position will be have to man by three different guys rotating in there. We won't get Martin's numbers by any one person, but hopefully collectively we'll be able to get something. But I do like what we will get from our perimeters in terms of what Keyshawn and Curtis bring, and then Brandon Rochelle, who's an all-league performer, coming back. So I think we have a chance to be pretty good, but, time will tell. And I said this about last year's team, we'll pick 10. So, time will tell, in terms of how we develop and how we come together throughout the season.
Last thing, you have a great relationship and a good affinity for Rick Barnes. I didn't like him when we played against him because I didn't know he was so sarcastic, right? I was a kid. I had no idea. And, I'd known him for a long time, sort of through Larry Shiat, who recruited the West Coast back when they were Providence. And I like Coach Shy, but I just didn't get – and then I got to know Rick Barnes. Like, he's the best. He's an unbelievable dude. Give somebody one story like this. Here's Rick Barnes in a nutshell. Go.
Oh my God. Where do I start? This guy was like, I tell you one of my favorite stories about Rick. We're Final Four, 2003. We're in the Final Four. We're playing Syracuse, and Rick is in the locker room. And I would always sit with him and joke with him and talk to him. And I'm serious. I kind of in and out, go get a bottle of water. And I walk back in the locker room, and the sucker's dead, dead to the bone sleep. He's out of it. And I don't bother him. I was like, man, I could almost hear him snore. He was stoned out of it. And all of a sudden, Rick Barnes, when the guys walk back in, he can turn it right on like a light switch. Yeah. And that guy's so impressive. And you know, the one thing that I learned from Coach is adaptability. And, you know, when we got T.J. Ford, and, you know, his Clemson teams, they were so motion-oriented and ball movement, you know, cutting. And they had those two big physical guys who were blocker screeners. And then when we got T.J. Ford, he was, you know, you put that ball in his hand, you let him play. So, to me, being able to adjust to your personnel, to me, that's coaching. That's what I learned from Coach. You know, having the trust in yourself and not being fearful to change. And he was so good at that. And I love him for giving me that quality. You know, when I look at my career as a head coach, I haven't been afraid to change and to learn. And you know, every year you're learning. You either get better or you get worse. You don't stay the same. And he's one of those guys that is always looking at new ways to get some things done. And, yeah, I think his defense has been pretty staple, but although I think he's changed that a little bit in terms of his aggressiveness on the ball, and that's kind of come and gone a little bit. But he's a special man. I mean, I love him. He's one of my best friends, and I love him for what he's done for me and my family, and rely on him. And you know, you've been around him. The guy's never had a dull moment. I mean, the guy's he's full of fun my wife absolutely loves Rick, and he's just so joyful, and he's just a great person. You know, he goes out of his way to do things for you. Man, he still has a insurance policy on my son that he pays and that he started. I mean, I worked for him, I don't know, 17 years ago, and we took it over, but he started it, and he's just a good human being and loves people.
Yeah, where we started is kind of where we ended, right? Because this is why basketball guys, I think, struggle so much, and coaches struggle so much with the idea of racism, because what you said, like, look, you got to learn, you got to evolve, you got to adjust, and if you can't learn, evolve, and adjust to the changing times and how views have changed and how people have changed, how you need to treat them, then you're going to be a dinosaur and you're going to be left behind. The same is true in life as it is in sports. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair, and that's a great segue to what we just talked about. That's awesome, but that's exactly the way life is and what you just said. And if you're not willing to change and adapt, you'll become stale and you retard your development. And that's life. And that's awesome, Doug. I appreciate you for saying that.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on with us. You've always been kind to me. You always have an unbelievable staff. I can't believe you have Jerry Wayne. We haven't told any Jerry Wainwright stories. Those will probably remain off air. But in the meantime, take care of your family and your team. Can't wait to see you guys back in the Reynolds Center next year. And thanks for joining me.
God bless you, Doug. Thank you.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Let me go from Frank Haith to Brandon Goebel. Now, we're in this kind of really odd new world, right? Where my dad for years had Branch West basketball, and he was like a placement service. And actually for years he did it for free, where he would have his players and he would find the right fit. And his belief was, you know, anybody who wants to play college basketball is good enough to start in their high school. We can find a place for you to play if you have grades, whether you play or not, you just make the team. There's so many different levels to it, or at least before COVID-19 and quarantine and the economy, there were a lot of levels to it. But then he basically ran a placement service. And, you know, you'd pay him to come evaluate your kid. Then he put together a highlight tape. And then he'd say, hey, look, if I get you to this level, this is the level I think your kid can play at. You pay me X, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Brandon does this, you know, goodness of his heart, unbelievable service to the kids. He just loves ball. And they go around the country, around the world. They put on camps, and they try and discover kids. And then, you know, bring the tapes back and send them out to, you know, put it on Twitter and just try and help. It's about the players. You can follow him on Instagram. And, of course, you can follow him on Twitter as well, at JUCO Advocate. He's become a good friend, and I think this is the perfect day to have him on as Brandon Goebel joins us here in the All Ball podcast. Brandon, let me start with this. This is just a weird year. There's no Hutch, right? So anybody who knows anything about JUCO basketball, you know, like that's what team needs a guy late in the year, and Hutch is different now, and JUCO basketball is different now than it's ever been. How different from your perspective as a guy who's covered this for years, you really know players and recruiting, and is the spring recruiting, non-recruiting period?
So it was definitely interesting to see as everything kind of fell apart really fast, right? Like there was a lot of people that were just kind of still doing their normal recruiting stuff, saying, hey, we're going to wait till Hutch. You know, we're not going to really hit some of the conference tournaments and things. Like, Hutch is going to be fine. Sure, everything's going to be fine. I was getting ready to go to Paris and run a camp over there and stuff. And then all of a sudden, everything just, like, collapsed. And so now all of a sudden, these coaches are going, we have these scholarships sitting here that we haven't done anything with. We haven't really dug in all that deep. We were waiting for Hutch, and now what do we do? And so all of a sudden, Synergy, right? Synergy was spiking. Like, their views on junior college stuff was going up anyways in January and February as people were kind of preparing. But their usage for junior college film just went through the roof. I mean, it's the most it's ever been by leaps and bounds. And so people were suddenly hammering tape and just trying to figure it all out and making a million phone calls, and it was a little bit chaotic, honestly. Guys were getting offers from places that you're like, oh man, like that's too high, or you know, that doesn't make any sense, or you know, it was just, I think guys didn't know what to do, and so there was a little bit of a panic that set in, and it's chilled out some since then, but it was wild for a little bit.
Who's been the most impressive, like in terms of some of their late gets that you've noticed?
Yeah, I think Kansas State actually did a really good job with getting Rudy Williams. And I know that saying like a high major and stuff is kind of odd in the sense that like they should be able to get just about anybody that they want. But that was a really important one. Point guards are really difficult to kind of lock down these days in junior college. There's just not a lot of true point guards.
Right, and they lost their point guard to transfer too. I mean, you know, so
yeah,
that's a you cannot play without a point guard.
Arguably the best point guard in the class, and to get him late like that with all of the wild stuff going on, I think that was a huge move because a lot of the other big guys signed early. I think BYU grabbing Gideon George late was like an all year process for them, and they were able to kind of take advantage of the fact that they were able to sneak in a visit right at the last second before everything went crazy when he went and visited during the Gonzaga weekend. That was a big one for them too.
What happens with the Oklahoma State recruit with Cade Cunningham? What do you think happens?
Oh man. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Cade just sticks it out for a year. Yeah. I think he knows that regardless of postseason or not, you know, what he does this season can still mean a lot. And there's just so many unknown weird things going on right now. Anybody making any sort of drastic decision is taking a big risk.
Here's what I've been told. I've been told the G League is telling these kids, hey, there's not going to be a college basketball season. So you're hanging around for nothing. You know, then the argument against the G League has been, you know, why would you want to play, even if you're making money, play meaningless games? And so the G League in turn for Cade Cunningham says like, yeah, our games don't necessarily mean anything, but neither does Oklahoma State. You can't play for a conference tournament and you can't play in the NCAA tournament. At least you can make some money. And I've been told he was offered a crazy amount of money back in December and January, and that amount might even go up.
At the end of the day, if the money makes sense for him or something, I mean, I guess you can never really knock a guy on that. But I think there's this huge misconception about out there of what the G League is and what the G League looks like when you play in it. I mean, these are a bunch of guys that, for all intents and purposes, most of them should be in the NBA, but there's just not enough spots. There's players that at any given moment could contribute to a team. So now you're in this different style of basketball that's somewhat difficult to evaluate, especially if you're a new guy that's coming in there. But if you go to a place like Oklahoma State, even for a year, and you don't play in the conference tournament, you don't play in the NCAA tournament, but you have an entire season of your non-conference and Big 12 basketball. I mean, G League is fine and all, but I feel like there's a lot to be made for him if he takes that chance and goes to college for a year.
I agree. Like, what do you mean? You're missing out on one or two Big 12 tournament games, maybe an NCAA tournament game or two, maybe three. Like, let's not act like they would be the best team in the country. They'd have a chance to be really good, and obviously it sucks, But your brother's there. You get a chance to play for your brother for a year. You get a chance to be part of a team. In your mind, I know Jalen Green is going to the G League. If you were going to take a kid in the end, those two, who would you take?
I'm probably taking Cunningham.
Why?
I think at the end of the day, what he does for me is an easier translation. So I got to watch him a little bit last summer, and I just thought that what he does is going to translate up a lot easier.
I agree. Like, I think he's a better basketball player. I think Jalen Green is a freak athlete who will make more jaw-dropping plays that look good, you know, on social media and on highlights. But Cade Cunningham really, really knows how to play basketball, and he can play multiple positions. Like, he checks so many boxes for what you need, not to be a good player, but to be a great player in the NBA. Green has this level of burst that few guys have, but there's some other kind of holes. He's becoming a better shooter, but he's got to be a better shooter. And, you know, Cade doesn't have to go to a team and be the best player immediately, and he can still be really, really effective. Whereas it feels like Jalen Green's only kind of played in a style in which he's, give me the ball, I'm going to just go get a bucket, you know?
Right. And when you look at some of, you know, even big names in the NBA, not the biggest names, right? Like, we're not talking about LeBron's and Kevin Durant's and things like that are just freak shows. But when you look at a lot of the guys in the NBA, guys that are successful, there's not a ton of them that do something that just is, you know, out of the stratosphere athletically or something like that. There's a lot of really good basketball players. And I think if you're a really good basketball player like Cade, like you said, that's going to translate faster. Now, Green could get there, you know, if he continues to improve, develop, and then all of a sudden you add that to the fact that he is a freak athlete. But right away, right off the bat, I'm probably taking Cade just because I know I'm getting a better basketball player right away.
You know what I love about your site, by the way, the site is verbalcommits.com. What I love about your site is it breaks it down through class and guys you're offering. And I think the whole thing's fascinating. But we did start to talk about the G League thing. And my deal is with the G League, like, in theory, it should be great, right? You take a handful of the kids that don't really want to go to college, that are really good enough. But the problem is, what we always see is, now there's going to be 100 kids that think they're one of the 5 kids that can go, right? And do they lock in on their... And oh yeah, by the way, like, what do you do, for example, UCLA? Like, UCLA, that sucks. You know, the second that staff got the job, they had one focus. You got Deshaun Nix, right, who's in Vegas. Like, that's the guy we need to go get. And they move mountains to do everything. They get him to commit. They get him to sign. He's in. And then late in the game, the G League comes in and says, well, what if we paid you $250,000? Now, you know, look, they still have Tyga, so they'll be okay. How do you think this G League thing affects not just what you do, but the overall landscape of college basketball recruiting?
You know, I think it's something that is going to be a little chaotic to start with, and will probably find its place, you know, much like when we were drafting straight out of high school. You know, there were guys that got drafted, and they made their money, you know, so you can't really blame them for that. They got drafted, but they flamed out, and people kind of went back and forth on, you know, taking too many high school guys, or maybe they should be taking more high school guys, and it kind of found its level before they shut that all down. And I think that's probably what's going to end up happening with the G League, because at the end of the day, if you've got, you know, 30, 40, 50 kids, whatever it ends up being, that decide to go straight to the G League, and only a few of them pan out, which is what is going to happen, people are going to probably start rethinking that pretty quick. You know, it's I don't love the fact that the NBA is using, you know, the D League and using some of the things, like they even do some of their stuff overseas, like with the African League that they're putting together. And all of a sudden, like, professional basketball is looking like the process rather than the reward, right? You know, and I think there's so many of these guys that are going to the G League that still owe quite a bit to the process and still have a lot to develop, but they're trying to jump straight to the reward right away. And
yes, well, that's always been the problem. Like, and even the success stories, like, this is where I'm different than other people. Dwight Howard's a success story, right? He goes, gets drafted in the NBA draft. He's probably a Hall of Famer. But you look at, like, did Dwight Howard actually live up to his potential? And I would tell you no. And I think that the things that he struggled with socially, like learning to be around others, and like there's an arrested development there. His personality, he just, I mean, I guess people always say, well, he's a weird cat. And maybe he was a weird cat before, and maybe he would have been a weird cat if he went to college. But there is something disarming about being around only people your age and having to live in dorms and that and play for a coach and play for a team. Whereas, you know, when you play professional basketball right away and you're an 18-year-old kid, like you're thrown into an adult world, there's a lot of things personally. And then his game itself, like he never really developed a post game. He never really developed a face-up game. And what happens is kind of what you show up and arrive as, you can become a better version of, but there's just some rounding out. Even LeBron has no idea, has never had any idea how to play without the basketball, ever. And I think that stuff would help. And I like, it's one of those questions where Jordan, to me, is the greatest of all time, but I think one of the things that really helped him, and he wouldn't have, he was a, people make it out like he was a scrub at a high school, like dude was a McDonald's All-American, set the all-time scoring record in the McDonald's game. But I do think that playing for Dean Smith rounded him out as a player, and then you combined it with otherworldly athleticism and talent, and he was able to become, you know, the all-time great. I just think there's so much missing, and we downplay it, but it does work. It doesn't mean that the other way won't work and doesn't provide opportunities, but no one who can really play has gone to college and all of a sudden, like, well, they can't actually play and the college ruined them. College doesn't ruin you. It simply promotes you and rounds you out for the most part.
And I get the thing with, you know, well, if I go to college and I hurt and I miss the opportunity, for sure. I mean, there's a risk in anything that you do. You go to the G League for, you know, $75,000 and get hurt, like it's over there too. You know, I'm a big believer in the best development system in the world before you're 18 is probably somewhere over in Europe. But once you turn 18, the best development system in the world is in college in America. And the G League is not set up, is not designed to provide that. It's not like we used to call it the D League, the developmental league. Not a lot of developing that goes on in that league. It's ride or die, like try and survive. And if somebody sees something that they need, then you get your shot in the NBA. And if you stay, awesome, right? Like it was perfect for a guy like Juan Toscano-Anderson that went to Marquette, still needed to develop a lot in his game, goes and plays pro down in Mexico, gets a shot in the G League, and then boom, takes off and heads to the Warriors. But like there was a lot of work that went in between that Warriors contract. And even when he was playing at Marquette, right? It wasn't, and he was a top, what, 150 kid? And so it wasn't just this like, oh yeah, I'm just going to go straight to the G League. And they're doing it with international guys too. You know, there's an Indian player that is phenomenal that's playing down in the Global Academy, and his government is like, no, he's just going to go straight to the G League. That's not what this is for, right?
Yeah.
Then the kid's college.
Well, and I think, and look, and I do think that the NCAA, they hurt themselves by making it harder for international players than it should be easier, right? There's, you know, Enes Kanter, like, yeah, Enes Kanter was a pro when he played in Turkey. I got it. Everyone knew he wasn't going to play in college. If they actually looked, they looked and nothing. But why? Like, if he wants to play in college, great. You know, who can, like, okay, so he got paid back home. I don't care. Is he getting paid here? You know, as long as he's not getting paid to come here, like, I'm good. That's fine by me. I do think that college basketball hurts itself. Give me the best tape that somebody sent you of a guy that you maybe hadn't heard of or hadn't seen, and somebody sends you a tape, and this can be any time during your time doing this, and you were like, holy shit, what did I just see? This kid can really play. Doesn't have to be not now, it can be any time.
You know, what's interesting is the international stuff is always one of those weird places where
so
now
hard.
You're dealing completely out of context.
Right, you have no idea who they're playing against. Right? You don't. I've seen international tapes people sent to me, like, hey, we signed this international kid. What do you think? I'm like, I don't know who he's playing against. Right? Because sometimes the game, it's like, is this played at half speed? Right? Is this a beer league? Or are these kids 15 or 16? And he's 18 or 19, right? Okay, but go ahead with the international stuff.
So the thing that really just surprised me about this one, this was a kid that was about to get ready to play U18 Division C, right? So we're down the line here in FIBA. And somebody sent me some tape on a kid named Owen Nelson who played junior college this year for Otero. And huge, right? He's 6'9", 6'10", somewhere in there. He's, at the time, he's probably 225, something like that. And this kid is running like a deer. He's about see-through. He's so white, being from Ireland, with this mop of red hair on his head. And I'm just like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, if this kid was in America right now, like, he'd be blowing the hell up because he's massive and he's athletic and he can catch and all this kind of stuff. And so somebody sent me this tape on this kid, and I was like, all right, I guess I'm diving into FIBA Division C and watched Ireland play. God, I don't even know. Like, some of the, you know, places like Micronesia and just these little countries and stuff. And sure enough, I mean, that kid just took off. He's going to Wyoming this year after 1 year in junior college. And it was eye-opening, because that was 3 years ago, I think, that I first saw him. And really, really exposed me to the fact that there are players everywhere, you know. And I've seen better days, right? I've seen better players, obviously. But that was one that was just shocking, where it's like, man, it doesn't matter where you're from. Yeah. Like, you
no,
can.
No, I remember Adidas Nations they used to have. And I don't know if they used to have it. I remember, like, the first year, and I was doing stuff with Adidas at the time. They had me come down to talk to the kids, and I think we're in New Orleans, and at then it was the Hornets facility, whatever, and it was just hot as can be. And I go in this gym, and I'm watching Team Africa play, and one guy looked different than everybody else. I was like, "Who's that dude?" They're like, "Serge Ibaka," and I was like, "There's your player." They're like, "Well, there's this guy." That guy's like, "No, that guy's your player." And I was just, the way he moved, the way he ran, the way he even shot the basketball at that time, that was before he's the shooter that he is now. You could just kind of tell those things are, but you're right. There's guys everywhere is a great one. Okay. How can people follow you? I gave away Twitter. I gave away verbalcommits.com. Anywhere else we can get all your information?
Yeah, I mean, really on Twitter is kind of our main communication source. That's where you'll see a lot of the stuff that we do when we go overseas. We go to Africa, the Caribbean, all that kind of stuff, run camps over there, help bring kids over to college. We've brought 22 kids over in the last 2.5 years and are playing in schools now. And then we do the Live Period podcast as well. That's been fun. We just kind of started that during the Rona and sat down and said, hey, you know what, let's do this. And it's been great. It's been fun. So it's allowing us to kind of get our message out there a little bit more and work on some different stuff and you know, just kind of find new things to get into.
Well, the best thing is, you know, you get to learn some of these kids' stories and meet them, and you end up wanting to cheer for them. It's a cool thing that you do. @JUCO Advocate is on Twitter. Brandon Goble is his name. Brandon, great catching up. We'll do so again in the very near future, and thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate you, my friend. Be good.
All right, that's it for All Ball. You can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, on Sirius XM. We're now on the Dan Patrick Channel, 203 and 217 Sirius XM. In the meantime, feel free to ask questions on the Instagram page, @Gottlieb Show, or the Twitter handle, @Gottlieb Show. Hope you appreciate listening to it. Thanks so much. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.